This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A first-of-its-kind study of Suffolk County criminal cases has found that declining to prosecute some low-level offenses can actually lead to less crime. The study analyzed more than 67,000 misdemeanor cases in Boston, Winthrop, Revere, Chelsea from 2004 to 2018, and it found that people arrested but not prosecuted on low-level, nonviolent misdemeanors were 58% less likely to commit another crime in Suffolk County in the following 2 years. So this was welcome news to Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, who pledged to not prosecute more than a dozen of these types of crimes when she ran for office in 2018. She joined us just a little earlier today to talk about how the findings of the study line up with her agenda. You took a risk right off the bat. You became DA and you made this data available to see what it would tell us, knowing that you were advocating for non-prosecution of some low-level crimes. So tell us how you believe this data supports your approach.
First off, yes, I think within 2 weeks of being inaugurated, right after January 2nd, 2019, a great group of women came to me and said, can we sift through all of your data? But you can't instruct us in any way. We have to have full autonomy to find what we find and be able to state with transparency what that is. Will you do it? And I signed immediately and said, absolutely. And so what I think this shows us, going back to 2004, is that what many progressive prosecutors have been saying is that we should be focusing our attention more on the violent, serious crimes. And when people come into contact for low-level, nonviolent crimes, when we are compassionate and allow them to go along on with their lives, if they have a mental health disorder, substance use disorder, something else, they often don't come back into contact with the criminal legal system. And we are safer as a result of that.
When you rolled that dice, how confident were you that the data was going to prove you right? And what would you have done today if the data had proved you wrong?
I was optimistic, but cautiously, right? I would not have proposed these policies had I not done a lot of legwork, speaking with members of law enforcement, criminal defense lawyers, judges, probation officers, victims and survivors of crime, returning citizens. And honestly, had this data shown something different, we would be adapting right now, because this is not about me and my policies. It's about keeping the people of Suffolk County safe and treating them with dignity and respect. And I believe that some of these individuals that get caught up in the criminal legal system, there are societal solutions that we can be pushing them toward. No one's saying they shouldn't be held accountable at all. I'm simply saying maybe accountability isn't the right word, number one. And number two, let's get them treatment and services they need. And it doesn't have to be at the Suffolk County House of Corrections, which costs you and I $55,000 a year to send someone to. I believe we can use that money to better serve not only our community writ large, but these individuals that are touching the legal system, often in crisis when they do.
So to be clear for our listeners, this study covered basically two tranches of data. There was 2004 to 2018, all of which is data from before your tenure. Then there was a chunk of limited data 2017 to 2020, which overlaps with your tenure. The obvious possible pushback would be, but listen, over time, as people come to feel confident that they will not be prosecuted for some lower level offenses, you may lose the deterrence of illegality. And the researchers said they couldn't address that pushback definitively either way, but they did note the crimes for nonviolent offenses on your list did continue to decline during the chunk of data that was during your term. So is there anything that accounts for that? I'm sort of going to make you discuss the reverse. Is there anything that could account for that other than you're right? Is it possible maybe we don't have enough time to know if the deterrence wears off? How do you address that?
You bet. I mean, how I address it is we're going to continue looking at the data always. One of the first things I did as district attorney was hire a chief of innovation and strategy and a data technologist that were going to be poking holes and looking into everything that we are proposing, right? There is an explore and exploit sort of right hand, left hand that I try to do as a leader in this job that I have right now. I want to do what we do well, which, and I have to give credit, we do great juvenile diversion stuff. I didn't create that. DA Conley did a wonderful job implementing a lot of those programs. We are going to exploit what we do really well there, but we are always going to be exploring other ways that we can be even better. Can we take that juvenile system mentality and expand it into our municipal and district courts, right? Can we do that without increasing harm to the people of Suffolk County or making people less safe in our community? And what I will tell you is, being unafraid of the data and being strong enough to say, hey, look, if this had said the exact opposite, we would be holding an emergency meeting with our law enforcement partners, who I respect deeply. I don't answer to them, but I respect them deeply, because they do the work every day in the trenches and say, all right, that doesn't appear to be working. What are we going to do next? Or this is what I'm proposing. Can I hear from you, your input, before we implement this? For me right now, it appears, according to this 16 to 17 years of data, that it is working what I have proposed and people before me had proposed. But I will tell you, I'm not confident in anything in 2020. With the year we had in 2020, I would never rest my laurels on 2020 showed us X, and therefore we're going to do it moving forward. And I don't want to wait.
Just because it was such an anomaly?
It's such an anomaly. We had a global pandemic hit us. We had a racial reckoning, the likes of which we haven't seen in decades, certainly. And we've had, you know, a lot of the stressors of crime exacerbated, right? With unemployment rising, food and housing insecurity with respect to evictions and foreclosures, even though we had a moratorium. We had parents that were working in first line responders in supermarkets, et cetera, that were also homeschooling, many of them English language learners or their children on IEPs. Those are all stressors that result in maybe more domestic violence, child abuse and neglect, or part one crimes under the FBI, the violent, serious crimes we're talking about. So what I promise we're going to do is we're going to look at this data in real time and adjust our nozzles as we need to moving forward. And we're not waiting 16 or 17 years to do it. We're going to be doing it now.
You have taken a lot of pushback. We've talked about it on this show before. Lots of pushback to this approach, especially your list of 15 crimes where you sort of instructed we're not going to prosecute with these crimes. Do you think this research will change your critics' minds on that idea?
No, because critics are going to be critics no matter what. And a lot of times people dig their heels in the sand. But here's what I can say. This is unbiased. I gave full access, and these team of female brilliant data specialists and researchers have come up with this information without me seeing it. I learned it with many of you, right? Today it's coming out, but I was not permitted to in any way edit anything that they did. What I can say to you is misdemeanor cases make up 80% of the cases processed in our United States criminal legal system. And if you look at the excellent criminal defense lawyers we have in Massachusetts, and we are really fortunate to have some of the best, Anthony Benedetti, the head of the CPCS, I think they spend 70 to 80% of their money on misdemeanors and low-level, non-violent, non-serious crimes, right? Municipal and district court misdemeanors. I want to spend my time solving homicides, rapes, kidnappings, armed assault with intent to murders, child sexual assaults, domestic violence cases, people that are harming individuals, right? That's where I want our time and resources. And I'm not saying there is no accountability for violating some of these 15 areas of crimes. All I'm saying is we have shown, data show, that we are not safer when we prosecute. In fact, people often come back into contact with the criminal legal system at a higher rate if we do, number one. And number two, I really want you to know that prior to me taking office, my predecessor was dismissing 42 of these percent of these type of cases anyways. He just wasn't telling you. I trust you all enough to hear what we're doing and to be transparent. I don't want to trick you into the way that we're thinking and being smart on crime. I want you to know. And if you're unhappy, then hold me accountable. And if somebody runs against me, vote them in. And if you are happy, okay, we can continue trying to do this. That's number one. Number two, very quickly, when I took office that year, 2019, we dismissed, declined, or diverted. It went from 42% under my predecessor to about 57%. So that was a 15% increase. There's a misconception and a lie that my opponents like to say that it maybe went from zero under my predecessor to 57%. It didn't. It went from 42% to 57%. And then the second really important piece is, and my math isn't great, but that means we prosecuted 43% of those things on my list of 15. People seem to say I decriminalized. I don't have the power to do that. The legislature does. What I do have the power to do, and do it quite well, is exert my prosecutorial discretion. And what I choose to do is work on the over 1,300 unsolved homicides in Boston. That's where I want my time and attention, not on a trespass in a park in a neighborhood in Roxbury that's been gentrified because now people don't want people from Roxbury in their park. No, that's not what we're spending our time on.
So I do want to, in our remaining time, I want to pick up on just a couple of other things. There's a lot more that we could talk about there, but yeah. I want to talk about the Hinton Lab Initiative. We covered this on WBUR last week. You are essentially reconsidering up to tens of thousands of drug convictions based on the Hinton Drug Lab scandal. We reported on it last week. Since then, DA Marion Ryan has let the SJC know that she's reopening or looking at some of those cases as well. Do you believe this needs to be a statewide effort, and do you think you're leading a charge that other DAs will follow and join you in?
My pleading is exclusive to Suffolk County, where I have full autonomy and have been given a mandate by the people of Suffolk County to lead the way that I lead as their elected official and the chief law enforcement officer. What DA Ryan did was ask our Supreme Judicial Court to make a determination for all 11 DAs, not just herself, the entire state. And as far as I'm concerned, she is fully entitled to do that. She is making decisions not just for her district, but asking the SJC to do things for the 10 others of us. All I'm doing is focusing on what's happening in Suffolk County. And let me be clear, Hinton Lab is in Suffolk County. It's in Jamaica Plain. It was when it was open. And it is a disgrace. It is a brand and a scar that we should be so humiliated by. The lack of oversight, the lack of audit function, and the sheer misconduct that went on. We are in Massachusetts known for not one, but two of the largest drug lab scandals in the history of the United States of America.
So then we can assume that you like DA Marion Ryan's move here and you're in support of it.
She's entitled to do what she wants. I will do in Suffolk County what I am doing. And we did it prior to her filing anything. So I am very proud to be a peer with a leader like DA Ryan, who has been leading this charge before I even became district attorney. And she is going to the SJC to ask permission. I am saying moving forward in Suffolk County, this is what we are doing. Because remember this, my name and all of those DAs, our name is on every pleading we file. Every pleading that's filed in Suffolk County has my name on it. I will not stand behind this gross misconduct and wild lack of oversight and management by not only our Department of Public Health, but the state police when they took over. And finally, Governor Patrick shut the lab down because it was so dysfunctional and awful.
So I do want to then ask you about John Verner, who works in your office now. I want to set this up for our listeners a little bit. You've talked strongly about this drug lab scandal. You've also praised defense attorney Luke Ryan for helping bring the extent of it forward. He had to fight to get access to documents in the AG's office. John Verner was one of the people in charge. He is now facing discipline, possible disbarment for that. Do you have concern that it undermines the credibility of what you're doing in Suffolk County or the appearance of it to have John Verner in your office now?
So John Verner was an assistant attorney general when all of this happened. When this happened, I was not the district attorney. When I took over this office, I didn't fire a single person when I started. And I firmly believe that people are innocent until proven guilty. And when the Ethics Commission or the Board of Bar Overseers or whoever the regulatory agency is that looks into alleged misconduct makes their determination, we will decide what it is we're going to do. What I can say is John Verner, I have not worked with him during that time. I have never hidden the fact that when I assumed this office, he worked there. And we will see what it is that is determined. And I think the determination is coming out soon. And we'll be transparent about what we're going to do at that time. But I will say in my time with John Verner, his work has been strong and solid. But we will see and move forward. And I'll have to make a decision.
Okay, one last quick question for you. It's been reported that you're a finalist for the job for United States Attorney for the District of Massachusetts under the Biden administration. Any updates you can provide for us in that process?
Wow. Who told you that?
Boston Globe reported it, actually, back in January.
No, I'm teasing you. There's nothing I can report. There's nothing I can report there. What I will say is I am humbled to be among the three women listed, two other women that are really strong candidates, both in the U.S. Attorney's Office, one that is a dear friend and former colleague, the other I haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet. We are going to be in really good shape if any of those two women are selected. And if I am fortunate enough to be considered for that, it would be, I'm very humbled to be even listed with their names.
Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, thanks for joining us.
Be well.
Joining us now, WBUR senior reporter Allie Germanning. Allie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you've been reporting on the study, Allie. Let me just start with getting your reactions to what we just heard from DA Rollins.
Yeah, this study is really fascinating. We just really haven't had access to this kind of data or analysis before. Before it was all kind of anecdotal. On one side, you had the progressive DAs and civil rights organizations saying that charging someone with a crime can have repercussions. It can make it harder for them to get a job, harder to get housing. It's just not good for them and it's not good for society. And on the other side, you have more hardline prosecutors, police unions, even business owners saying, if you don't prosecute these crimes, people will go wild, stealing, doing drugs, basically be lawless. And this independent research seems to suggest that the progressive groups are more right. And not only are people less likely to commit a crime again if they don't get a criminal record in the first place, the researchers also found that petty crime did not rise over the last 3 years. In Boston, they looked at Boston police data. There were significant reductions in property damage, theft, and fraud since Rollins took office. And there was no increase in disorder or drug crime reports.
So you heard us talk about this a little bit. District Attorney Rollins is one of many progressive DAs who have received real pushback for their approach toward crime. A couple examples, former U.S. Attorney Bill Barr called progressive prosecutors, quote, anti-law enforcement, end quote, who let criminals off the hook. DA Michael O'Keefe off the Cape and Islands 2 years ago in a Boston Globe op-ed criticized, quote, social justice candidates, end quote, saying it's not the role of a DA to make these kinds of reforms. Do you think this study will change the political conversation around progressive prosecutors like DA Rollins? She wasn't sure it would.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear her say kind of a flat no. But, you know, she's not the only progressive DA out there. You know, they've been elected in Chicago, Philly, Austin, recently in Los Angeles. So it could affect who is running and what kind of platform that they run on. It was interesting what she had to say about the difference between DA Conley, her predecessor, and her in terms of the percentage points of how many misdemeanors they were dismissing. It wasn't that far off. And, you know, to get back to the DAs, you know, this really seems to support Rollins and others like her. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the political conversation changes about this.
So the study underscores the importance of having data, Allie, and we know Massachusetts is behind on data collection, electronic court records. What do we have to do in order to enable the kind of data availability that leads to this type of research?
Yeah, this is like my pet peeve about working in Massachusetts. And I think for a lot of researchers, too, is, you know, despite being this higher ed and tech hub here, our court system is just incredibly paper-based. The researchers for this study, they noted that the way that data gets inputted into the DA system is basically administrative assistants hand enter information that are on paper forms into a database. So lots of information was missing, especially for those cases that were dismissed, because if you're going through the stack of papers, oh, this one's not going to go forward, we don't need to worry about it as much if you have a whole larger stack of cases that are going to get pursued. So some things were missing, like who the prosecutor was, what the race and gender was of the defendant, you know, things like that. And this isn't new. This isn't the first research group to say this. Harvard researchers who studied the mass court system last year found racial disparities in how people were treated, and they noted how bad data collection was. Like, there was no linking between district court and superior court charges if it was for the same person. There was missing racial data, missing information about final convictions. It didn't say whether charges were amended as part of a plea deal. And Rollins and two state reps actually wrote an op-ed last year about the lack of data sharing and tracking, not only by DA's offices, but by police departments and the trial court. So at some point, I hope we see a focus on fixing these gaps and bringing Massachusetts into the 21st century.
So briefly, you heard us ask Rollins for any update on the U.S. attorney's job for the District of Massachusetts. She didn't have any, but what would she bring to the table as a U.S. attorney?
Yeah, so Rollins, she's a former U.S. attorney, and the three other finalists that the Globe mentioned are all former U.S. attorneys. So it really appears the selection committee is prioritizing experience at the federal level, particularly prosecutors. And three of those four finalists are women, and all of them, all four, have backgrounds focusing on civil rights. So we can definitely expect quite a change from Andrew Lelling, who was Trump's appointee and definitely more conservative.
And just to clarify, she was a former assistant U.S. attorney.
Yes,
is that
I'm sorry,
right?
A former assistant U.S. attorney. Yes, I misspoke.
And the same with the others?
Yes.
Great.
Two of them are still in there. Another one is a former.
Perfect. WBUR senior reporter Allie Jarmanning. Allie, thanks.
Thank you.
So we've been talking this hour about a new report that shows declining to prosecute some low-level offenses might actually lower subsequent crime. Before the break, we spoke with Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, who made this a central campaign issue when she ran for office in 2018 and agreed to let researchers access the data necessary to conduct this study when she took office. We also heard some analysis of the report from our reporter, Allie Jarmanning. So for more, we're going to turn now to Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be on.
So, Judge Gertner, this feels like really important data, is it?
It, of course, is important data. I mean, I think that it shows something which sort of seems to be intuitive, actually, and was obviously intuitive with prosecutors long before Rachel Rollins, who did it without announcing it, which is that when people get swept up into the criminal legal system because of a misdemeanor or because of a minor nonviolent offense, the system begins to have an impact on their life that is disruptive and then can lead to further encounters with the criminal legal system. You lose your job, you lose your family, you wind up with a criminal record, it has implications for employment, and it leads to a spiral. So that was the anecdotal story about why you wanted to limit the circumstances under which people, and particularly young people, were swept up into the criminal legal system. So this really helps support that observation, that intuitive observation. And as I said, prosecutors have done that since the beginning of prosecutorial discretion.
So I know you heard our conversation with DA Rollins. Any surprises in that there, or anything you want to pull out of what she had to say about the data, the report, and what it means?
Well, it was interesting. I take as well the point that she didn't think that this would lead to other prosecutors doing what she has done, that she was skeptical that they would be moved by it. Now, the interesting thing about that is that they always have. The stories about how D.A. Connolly was essentially doing the same thing, but didn't do it out loud. It was declining, but didn't do it out loud. And she fears
he was her predecessor.
He was
just
her
to
predecessor.
Clarify, right?
She fears that other DAs will not. You know, it's become sort of the functional equivalent of masks. Right? I'm not going to do it because she's doing it, even if what she's doing is right and has made an impact. You have limited resources in any prosecutor's office, and you use those resources to focus on the things that are serious. and you leave other mechanisms to deal with things that are not serious. But we can't prosecute every single thing. And so for me, the surprising thing was that she didn't think that others would say, hey, this is interesting, let me do it.
That is interesting, because isn't the point public safety? And if this actually leads to less future crime and less cost in overall prosecution, shouldn't there be an obligation to do something in response to this kind of data?
Right. And so one of the issues is to hold, we talk about progressive prosecutors, but one issue is holding other prosecutors to the same standards. So in the next race for DA in Bristol or you know, wherever, you ask the prosecutor whether he will do this in the light of this study. And that would be an interesting question. I mean, part of this started, you know, years and years ago to some degree with Bill Bratton in Boston, with the notion that broken windows crimes, the low-level crimes, lead to more serious crime, and therefore you should nip them in the bud. There are, of course, the other answer to broken windows crimes is to fix the broken window. In other words, to deal with the communities in which this is happening and help and support those communities address those issues, misdemeanor issues. But if you criminalize broken windows types crimes, lower level, lower echelon crime, you create a pattern in which you disable those people from actually getting out of whatever spiral they're in. This is interesting, and it's now corroborated by the data.
So it's interesting you bring up Bill Bratton, who was law enforcement, former commissioner here in Boston. And you heard me talk to D.A. Rollins about this deterrence question. So if there are certain crimes for which someone knows it becomes the common practice to no longer prosecute, do you expect that the data will show that over time illegality will reduce deterrence?
Well, first of all, the crime rate is not... we have a theory of deterrence, but oftentimes crimes are not caused by what we choose to prosecute or what we don't choose to prosecute. In other words, there's a mismatch between what we prosecute and the impact of that prosecution on the community. So the fact that you don't prosecute shoplifting doesn't mean that everyone will go shoplift. It doesn't, because to some degree, even D.A. Rollins wasn't saying that I'll never do it. But no one has shopped. Oftentimes, people are not shoplifting because they're making a calculation that they won't be prosecuted. We assume a rationality to people who are engaging in crime, which oftentimes is not true. So it's possible, I suppose, if when you say I'm not going to prosecute marijuana, for example, oftentimes that will lead to more people smoking marijuana. There's no question about that. But the kinds of crimes that are oftentimes crimes of convenience, crimes of necessity, those are not going to be changed by what we choose to prosecute. And in any event, one of the things that D.A. Rollins was saying, which makes a great deal of sense, is there's a cost-benefit here. Okay, stop this shoplifter at the price of then burdening this defendant with consequences that will in fact lead him further into crime or dysfunctional behavior. So you make a cost-benefit analysis there, and that's what she was doing, and that's what prosecutors have been doing for the longest time.
Let's talk for a second about the Hinton Lab Initiative. It takes a second look at thousands of drug convictions that involve findings from the Hinton Drug Lab. D.A. Marion Ryan is asking the SJC to, as I understand it, essentially consider cases across all D.A. jurisdictions. What do you expect from the Supreme Judicial Court on this?
It's hard to know. It is a different court than the court that was so attentive to these issues only, 2 years ago, the court that was under the leadership of Chief Justice Ralph Gantz. So it's hard to know. But the argument that they're making is that this was a misconduct of an extraordinary level. It's not just, Annie Duquesne, who was one of the chemists, made a mistake on one or two cases. It was a sustained misconduct. And Farrakh, who was the one from Western Massachusetts, was in the Hinton lab. It was a failure of supervision, which cast doubt on everything that came out of that lab. It really was at a level which we should simply take responsibility for. And what happened here is because the courts were to some degree slow to react, there were people who pled guilty who could well have litigated this and who now wind up with convictions that they shouldn't have had. Pled guilty and, you know, saying, I don't want to wait for the courts. Who knows what they will do? Therefore, I will plead guilty. Yeah. And therefore, pleading guilty based on findings which are flawed. Right. And so this is a big deal, and it's right to take it in a responsible, systematic way.
So before you go, I want to ask you a couple of questions about Derek Chauvin's trial, which begins today. He pleaded not guilty to second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter charges in the death of George Floyd. What are you watching for? And it's been a controversial process to get to this point. Any legal red flags or things that you've seen that concern you?
Well, what he is likely to do is what police officers have done in other situations, which is to candidly divert attention from what he was doing on the video that everybody saw. What are the kinds of diversions that you would see? Well, one I've heard is the autopsy for George Floyd suggested that there were chemicals in his body, and so one. Tactic could we to say that his death was not attributable to the 8 minutes of a knee on his neck, but rather was attributable to something else in his body. And because this is a manslaughter charge, anything that breaks the causal link between the death of George Floyd and Chauvin's conduct would be a defense, would be an arguable defense. I say arguable because it seems clear, at least from what we see on television, that whatever was going on with George Floyd would not have led to his death but for the knee on the neck. The other thing they're trying to do is to suggest that Floyd just saw this on television, that there had been an earlier episode in which he was arrested and he essentially decompensated and was difficult to control in an earlier environment. Again, they want to say that's the person they were dealing with, and that's why he had to do what he did. Personally, it doesn't go very far in my view, but diversion and focusing on technical issues rather than the minutes that we all saw on camera. I was saying it's like the Rodney King case, was it 20 or 30 years ago, where a black guy was beaten up by the police and was caught on tape. And the police officers were exonerated because they said, hey, let me tell you what was going on off tape. Let me tell you all the things that he was doing and scaring us and making us reasonably concerned about our life. Well, this is essentially, what are they going to say that was off tape?
So,
a prior episode, causation issues, what was off tape?
So just very briefly, there's a lot of data to suggest that it's less than likely that Chauvin will be convicted of murder. Is there something mitigating in this case that might change the pattern of conviction rates for police officers in these kinds of trials?
Hard to say, except this is one of the most diverse juries that Hennepin County has ever produced. And black jurors matter, and they matter not just because, you know, not in the sense that they will automatically vote for against the police, but it matters because they can put what they see in a different context than a white suburban juror might. They will not be as swayed by the off-tape argument as would a white juror. So the jury is quite diverse, and that's significant. That's one fact, but, you know, jurors give the police the benefit of the doubt, which is why verdicts have gone the way they have. They give police the benefit of the doubt in the way they wouldn't give you or me. I don't know about you getting the benefit of the doubt, but I would.
I think you would. And that's Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, right? Senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
All this hour, we've talked about crime and punishment and redemption. Our final story today, it takes us way back, all the way back to 1638, Providence, and the brutal murder of a young Native man that sparked a dramatic manhunt and eventually a murder trial. and a conviction that may have shaped our legal system since then. Or so argues author and historian Toby Pearl in her new book, Terror to the Wicked, America's First Trial by Jury That Ended a War and Helped Form a Nation. Toby Pearl, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Toby, why did you embark on this journey of research and writing of this book about this little known historical moment? I knew nothing about it before reading the book.
Sure. I was in the same situation myself when I came across the events. I am an attorney. I once practiced law and I've served on a jury on a criminal trial. And when I came across these events from 1638 outside Plymouth Colony, this brutal murder and unlikely, remarkable manhunt that followed, and then this landmark jury trial, I was in awe of what I saw. One, because I'd never come across these events in the history books before, and two, because the more I looked into it, the more I realized that Plymouth Colony at this moment had been in such a precarious situation. And yet there was this deep desire to ensure that a jury trial was available as a safeguard against injustice. And I was fascinated and kind of wanted to dive deeper into the research to figure out why, of all the rights we kind of associate with our democracy, why was the jury trial so important to these early settlers?
And why argue the long tail on that jury trial to who and what we are today?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting when former Plymouth Colony Governor William Bradford in 1623 wrote down the order demanding jury trials for those accused of a criminal infraction. The settlers at that time were in desperate straits. They were in a hand-to-mouth existence dealing with starvation, and I realized that there was something important to the settlers regarding jury trials, and that they themselves had faced persecution, physical torture, branding, being thrown in dungeons in England, and had left that behind. And they saw jury trials as this one structure that might be able to act as a safeguard against the worst kind of injustice. And when we look at authoritarian measures that could hamper free speech or other actions that leave people vulnerable to abuse from the governing authorities, jury trials are the one answer to kind of step forward and have 12 citizens stand watch and say, we're going to be the ultimate arbiters of what is justice. And it struck me as very interesting because this was during a time when free speech wasn't very much protected. Other parts of our democracy were nascent, and yet this was that one step that was considered so fundamental. And I think till to this day, it still exists as an ultimate protection. And when you look at countries where a jury might not be available, and I look at what Alexei Navalny is dealing with in Russia, for example, where it certainly appears he did not have access to a jury trial, you can see how quickly things unravel in terms of that fight for justice.
He's a dissident in Russia, just for listeners who might not have recognized that. So there's more I want to get to in the book. There's some really interesting history, but I want to take a couple things head on first. A couple of historians have taken issue with your framing of the book, and I want to take those things head on. First, in the New York Times, historian Francis Bremer argues not the first trial by jury. He says that was 1630. And that he argues it didn't really help end the war. The Pequot War was close to ending already. I'm sure you've seen that criticism. What's your response to that?
Sure. This trial, at the time this happened, 1638, end of July, battles were ongoing from 1636 until 1638 for the Pequot War. And the murder happened in end of July, 1638. And you have the murder victim living long enough to report the details of his crime to none other than founder of Providence, Rhode Island, Roger Williams. And it doesn't take much examination of the writings of Roger Williams to see his grave concern at the time that this murder is going to be seen as an action that could have very much further ignited the ferocious attempted genocide and battles of the Pequot War.
So it really essentially kept it, the fact that there was a trial kept the fact of the crime from essentially reigniting the war. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely correct. The jury trial took place on September 4th, 1638. And you can see the investment both among Indigenous peoples and settlers in this jury trial. And then it was about 2.5 weeks later that you see the Pequot War ending by treaty resolution rather than the war continuing on.
And what about the pushback that the first jury trial was in fact in 1630?
Right. You have different scholars looking at events differently. This is the first, certainly at the time, you have the leaders of the settlers describing this as a landmark jury trial. And this is the first trial where you have the jurors identified by name. You have two witnesses who were members of the Narragansett tribe testifying at trial. You have all of these details recorded, and you have the legal analysis provided by Roger Williams. So there was certainly a murder that predates this trial, but this, in my eyes, is certainly the first full-fledged landmark criminal jury trial of the era.
So really the one we would sort of recognize as a trial the way we know it today.
Certainly.
All right, so what was interesting to me in reading the book was the tension that you raise and the resolution that you offer to it. And obviously it's not like you made it up, right? That you report to us about who gets justice. So we have a victim, and I think I've got his name right, in Penawinyanquis, who was trading fur. He is set upon by a group called the Peach Gang, four of whom attacked him, one of whom later escapes, and three go to trial. They think they've killed him. He actually survives the night and is able to find his way to other white settlers to whom he tells his story, and then he dies, and that then leads to the prosecution. What is remarkable about who gets justice and who is prosecuted, and why was that so striking?
It's a great question. So the leader of this so-called Peach Gang, these four men, was a man named Arthur Peach, who was an indentured servant, and he was also a Pequot War veteran. So this very same war that's unfolding as these events transpired, Peach had fought in this war, in these battles, and there was every rumbling in the settlement during these events indicating that settlers in Plymouth Colony and beyond were loath to see a Pequot War veteran, a fellow settler, prosecuted at a criminal trial for the murder of an Indigenous man. Heartbreaking as that is to realize, that was kind of the rumbling that was going on at the time. So there was a real question mark. Would the settlement be able to put on a trial, find 12 jurors from this relatively small population of about 550 people at the time, who would be willing to sit and listen to the evidence and not make a decision in the outcome of the trial that was based on an identity or a shared feeling of identity of who was being prosecuted, but on the evidence? And this was an excellent example that this could work, that people could look truly to the evidence and make a decision based on evidence alone.
So you've got the potential for bigotry and prejudice. You've got people on two sides of a war. You've got the fact that the accused were, in fact, I think they were all indentured servants who escaped. So there were caste and class issues here. The verdict was by no means a shoo-in. It really was kind of one of those dramas that everyone hung on the edge of their seat until the jury came back.
That's exactly right. There was no sense that the trial was going to reveal itself this way. Every settler, the colonial leaders at the time, from present day Boston, Moss Bay Colony to Plymouth Colony, Roger Williams in Providence, everyone was very much concerned, waiting for the outbreak of more battles in the Pequot War, this uncertainty. And you even have Massasoit Ussumeequin, the sachem of the Wampanoag at the time, intervening and going to speak with settlement leaders, suggesting that perhaps not all four of the indentured servants should be found guilty. So there was this real parsing out of shared guilt, who would be guilty for this crime and why, and by no means was the outcome of the trial a foregone conclusion.
And pretty much all the players recognized that they were setting precedent, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, again, these settlers, kind of their one grievance of many, but right at the forefront, leaving, being tortured and suffering injustices in England, was that they would have justice and liberty here in these settlements that they were founding. And I try and shine a very bright light on the dark irony that even as they sought out these liberties and sought out these very early building blocks of our nation's democracy, they also chipped away at these liberties when they did not extend them to Indigenous peoples.
Toby, in our brief time remaining, one of the things you're given credit for in this book is bringing forward Native voices and the Native perspective, which as a country that's just marked the 400th year since the Pilgrims landed here, often have been erased from history. What kind of research did you do to make sure you were being robust there?
Well, thank you for that question, because it's this is one area that I'm very proud of. I did a tremendous amount of research, and certainly the Mashantucket Pequot Research Center was an invaluable resource, both from their archaeological efforts, but scholarship and the many other resources that we have outside of archives, which don't do a good job of offering historical evidence for Indigenous peoples, for women, for a whole variety of folks who are often left out of our histories. And these events have been told in scholarly journal articles. But what I am most proud of is that I was able to reveal the identity of Roger Williams' slave, who was sent out into the woods to pursue the indentured servants during this manhunt for the murderers. And the identity took me a while to piece together, probably over a year. And I was astounded to find that that person was a young boy of the Pequot tribe named Will, who was about 10 or 11 years old.
So bringing somebody forth into the historical narrative who had not been there before. It's a fascinating book. Thank you so much. Toby Pearl is the author of the new book, Terror to the Wicked, America's First Trial by Jury That Ended a War and Helped Form a Nation. Toby, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tiziana. A pleasure.
All right, listeners, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.